Chapter 11. It was the state of the squash court that made me realise my passion for collecting had, perhaps, got the tiniest bit out of control. The squash court was one of the things that I'd liked about Woodside when I first moved in. I would challenge anyone who came over to a game. But no one had played squash at Woodside for some time, because no one could actually get into the court anymore. The place was full of packing cases, and the packing cases were full of things I'd bought. On tour, on holiday, from auctions, whatever. I hadn't been able to unpack any of it because there was literally no room anywhere in the house to put any more stuff. Every inch of wall space was covered with paintings, posters, gold and platinum discs, framed awards. My record collection was piled up all over the place. I had a special room for it that was like a maze with corridor after corridor of floor-to-ceiling shelving that housed everything I'd bought since I was a kid. I still had the 78s I'd spent my pocket money on in Sivers in Pinner, with Reg Dwight written on the labels in ink and photos of the artists I'd cut out of magazines sellotaped to the sleeves. But I'd managed to outgrow the room by buying someone else's record collection as well. He was a BBC radio producer called Bernie Andrews, who had worked on Saturday Club with John Peel, and he owned every single released in Britain between 1958 and 1975. Thousands and thousands of the things. Of course, loads of them were absolutely crap. Even in pop's most miraculous years, the good releases were outweighed by the bad. But it appealed to my completist collector's mentality. Owning every single released in Britain. It was like some mad childhood fantasy come true. If I'd just collected records, I might have been able to cope. But I didn't. I collected everything. Art, antiques, clothes, chairs, jewellery, glassware. There were beautiful Art Deco vases and galley and Tiffany table lamps just sat on the floor because there was no space left on any tables. A pretty incredible state of affairs given how much furniture I'd managed to cram into every room. Walking around the house was like taking part in the world's most expensive obstacle course. If you put a foot wrong or turn round too quickly, which I can tell you for a fact is quite easy to do if you're spending a significant portion of your life drunk and on drugs, you could smash something worth thousands of pounds. It didn't really make for a terribly relaxing environment in which to live. I'd have people over and spend half of my time bellowing at them to be careful or to watch what they were doing. I'd occasionally stick my head round the door of the squash court. There was just about enough room to do that if you breathed in, and feel oddly despairing. Ever since I was a kid, owning things had always made me feel happy. But now, it just made me feel overwhelmed. What was I going to do with all this stuff? A few months after Renata and I separated, I came up with a radical solution. I was going to sell it. All of it. Every painting, every bit of memorabilia, every stick of furniture, every objet d'art, all the clothes, all the jewellery, all the glasses, all the gifts that fans had sent me. Everything in the house, except the records. I got in touch with Sotheby's, who had recently held a huge posthumous sale of Andy Warhol's possessions, and told them I wanted to auction the lot. They sent experts out to Woodside to have a nose around. The experts left looking a little faint. I couldn't work out whether they were floored by the quantity of stuff I was selling. One of them told me in hushed tones that I had the largest private collection of Carlo Bugatti furniture in the world, or whether they were just reeling from the sheer hideousness of some of it. I liked to think I had developed a good eye for art and furniture, but I also had a remarkably high threshold for gaudy kitsch. There were things in my home that made my old stage outfits look like the last word in understated good taste. There was a model of a bonobo gorilla in an Edwardian dress that a fan had sent me, with an accompanying note explaining that it was a sculpture representing the futility of war. There was a radio in the shape of a doll wearing a see-through negligee. The volume and tuning controls were mounted on her tits. There was a pair of brass bath taps with large perspex testicles attached to them. I decided that I should keep some original Goon Show scripts, complete with Spike Milligan's handwritten annotations, that I'd bought at auction, and four paintings. Two Magrittes, One Francis Bacon portrait of his lover George Dyer that people had told me I was crazy to spend £30,000 on back in 1973. And the Guardian Reader's The Patrick Proctor painting that had appeared on the cover of Blue Moves. Everything else could go. Before you get the wrong idea, I should add that I had absolutely no intention whatsoever of leading a more simple and meaningful life, uncoupled from the yoke of consumerism and unencumbered by material possessions. If anyone thought that, they were swiftly disabused the first time I went to Sotheby's for a meeting about the upcoming auction. Supposedly there to discuss disposing of my worldly goods, I instead ended up buying two paintings by Russian avant-garde artists Igor and Svetlana Kopistiansky. It was more that I wanted a new start. I wanted to completely remodel and redecorate Woodside. I didn't want to live in a berserk pop star's house anymore. I wanted somewhere that felt like a home. It took Sotheby's 3 days just to transport everything from Woodside to their London warehouse. There was so much to sell that there had to be 4 separate auctions. One was for stage costumes and memorabilia, one for jewellery, one for Art Deco and Art Nouveau, and one called Diverse Collections, which had everything in it from Warhol silk screens to suitcases to sporrans. At some point, I appeared to have bought 2 of those. I used a photo of some of the lots on the cover of my new album, which I'd called Reg Strikes Back. It seemed like the right title after the events of 1987. Sotheby's held an exhibition before the auction. They only showed a quarter of what was up for sale, but it filled the Victoria and Albert Museum. Bizarrely, the former Prime Minister, Edward Heath, came to have a look at it. Maybe he was in the market for a pair of bath taps with Perspex testicles attached. The auctions were a huge success. They had to put up crash barriers outside to cope with the crowds. Paintings sold for double the anticipated price. Things that I thought fans might pick up for a few quid went for thousands. Everything went. The bonobo gorilla representing the futility of war. The sporrans. The doll in a negligee radio. They even sold the banners that hung outside Sotheby's advertising the auction. I didn't go. I left Woodside the day the removal vans arrived. I didn't set foot in the house again for 2 years. I wasn't to know it then, but by the time I came back, my life would have changed even more than my home had. I decided to move to London while the house was being emptied. At first I stayed in a hotel, the Inn on the Park, the location for the famous story about me ringing the Rocket office and demanding they do something about the wind outside that was keeping me awake. This is obviously the ideal moment to state once and for all that this story is a complete urban myth. That I was never crazy enough to ask my record company to do something about the weather. That I was simply disturbed by the wind and wanted to change rooms to somewhere quieter. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that, because the story is completely true. I absolutely was crazy and deluded enough to ring the international manager of Rocket, Robert Key, and ask him to do something about the wind outside my hotel room. I certainly didn't want to change rooms. It was 11 a.m, I'd been up all night, and there were drugs everywhere. The last thing I needed was the hotel staff bustling in to help me move to a different floor. I angrily outlined the situation to Robert. To his lasting credit, he gave my request very short shrift. On the other end of the phone, I heard the muffled sound of Robert, with his hand over the receiver, telling the rest of the office, "Oh God, she's finally lost it." Then he spoke to me again. "Elton, are you fucking insane? Now get off the phone and go back to bed." I started renting a house in West London. But I spent most of my time away on tour or in America. I'd fallen in love with a guy called Hugh Williams who lived in Atlanta, but I also found myself in Indianapolis. Ryan White had been happier since moving to Cicero, but nothing could stop the progress of his disease. In the spring of 1990, his mother Jean called and told me that he had been rushed into the Riley Hospital for Children with a severe respiratory infection. He was on life support. I flew there straight away. For the next week, I tried to make myself useful around the hospital while Ryan slipped in and out of consciousness. I didn't know what else to do to help. I cleared up the room. I fetched sandwiches and ice cream. I put flowers in vases and bought stuffed animals for the other kids on the ward. I acted like Jean's secretary, fending off phone calls, doing the job that I paid Bob Halley to do for me. Ryan had been such a visible advocate for AIDS sufferers that he had become a celebrity. When the news that he was dying got out, Jean was deluged with people wanting to offer their support, and it was too much for her to deal with. I held the phone up to Ryan's ear when Michael Jackson called. All Ryan could do was listen. He was too weak to answer. When I went back to my hotel, I would think about Jean and her daughter, Andrea. They were watching Ryan die, slowly and painfully. They had prayed for a miracle, but the miracle never came. They had every right to feel angry and resentful. But they didn't feel that way. They were stoic, they were forgiving, they were patient and kind. Even in the most awful circumstances, I loved being around them. But they made me feel ashamed of myself, in a way I'd never felt before. I spent half my life feeling angry and resentful about things that didn't matter. I was the kind of person who got on the phone and shouted at people because the weather outside my Park Lane hotel didn't suit me. Whatever else had been wrong with my childhood, I hadn't been brought up to behave that way. How the fuck had I become like this? I'd always managed somehow to justify my behaviour to myself, or to make a joke of it. But now I couldn't. Real life had barged into my celebrity bubble. Because they knew I was in Indianapolis, I was asked to play a gig at the Hoosier Dome for Farm Aid, a charity set up by Neil Young, Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp. It was a huge event, with everyone from Lou Reed to Carl Perkins to Guns N' Roses performing. I had been happy to get involved, but now I didn't want to go, because I didn't want to leave Jean by Ryan's bedside. I knew he didn't have long left. I rushed over there and literally ran on stage in the same clothes I'd been wearing at the hospital. I played without a backing band, raced through Daniel and I'm Still Standing, dedicated Candle in the Wind to Ryan, then ran off stage again. I was back at the hospital within an hour, and I was there when Ryan died the next morning, 8th of April, at 7:11 a.m. He was 18. It was a month before his high school graduation. Jean had asked me to be one of the pallbearers at his funeral, and also to perform. I sang Skyline Pigeon with a photo of Ryan on top of my piano. It was a song from my first album, Empty Sky. One of the first really good things Bernie and I had written, and it seemed to fit the occasion. Dreaming of the open, waiting for the day that he can spread his wings and fly away again. The funeral was a huge event. It was broadcast live on CNN. Michael Jackson and the First Lady, Barbara Bush, were there. There were press photographers everywhere and hundreds of people standing outside in the rain. Some of the mourners were people who had made the whites' lives a misery back in Kokomo. They came and apologised and asked Jean to forgive them. And she did. Ryan was in an open casket. After the service, family and close friends filed towards his body to say goodbye. He was wearing his faded denim jacket and a pair of mirrored sunglasses, his choice of clothes to be buried in. I put my hands on his face and told him I loved him. I went back to my hotel in a strange mood. It wasn't just grief, there was something else bubbling underneath. I was angry at myself. I kept turning over the fact that Ryan had done so much in such a short time to help people with AIDS. A kid with nothing, and he'd changed public perceptions. Ronald Reagan, who'd done his best to ignore AIDS while he was president, had written a piece that the Washington Post published that morning, praising Ryan and condemning the fear and ignorance that surrounded the disease. I was the highest profile gay rock star in the world. I'd spent the 80s watching friends and colleagues and ex-lovers die horribly. Years later, I had all their names engraved on plaques and put them on the wall of the chapel at Woodside. But what had I done? Virtually nothing. I had made sure I got tested for HIV every year, and by a miracle I came up negative every time. I had played a couple of benefit gigs, and helped record a charity single, a version of Burt Bacharach's That's What Friends Are For with Dionne Warwick, Stevie Wonder and Gladys Knight. It had been a huge success. It was the biggest selling single of the year in America and it raised $3 million. I had attended some of Elizabeth Taylor's fundraising events because I'd known Liz for years. She had a grand image, but she wasn't like that at all in real life. She was incredibly kind and welcoming and she was hilarious. She had a really filthy English sense of humour. Although you had to watch your jewellery around her, she was obsessed. If you were wearing something she liked the look of, she'd somehow just charm you into giving it to her. You would walk into her dressing room wearing a Cartier watch and leave without it. Never entirely sure how she'd managed to get it off you. I suppose she used exactly the same skill when it came to fundraising. She had the guts to stand up and do something. Helping start the American Foundation for AIDS Research, forcing Hollywood to pay attention, despite everyone telling her getting involved with AIDS would damage her career. I should have been doing the same. I should have been on the front line. I should have put my head on the chopping block the way Liz Taylor did. I should have been marching with Larry Kramer and ACT UP. Everything I'd done so far, charity singles, celebrity fundraisers, seemed superficial and showbizzy. I should have been using my fame as a platform to gain attention and make a difference. I felt sick. I turned on the TV and watched the news coverage of the funeral, which only made things worse. It was a beautiful service and my performance had been fitting. But every time the camera focused on me, I was horrified. I looked awful in a way that had nothing to do with the tragedy of Ryan's death and everything to do with the way I was living my life. I was bloated and grey. My hair was white. I looked worn out, exhausted, ill. I was 43 years old and I looked about 70. God, the state of me. Something had to change. But not yet. I left Indianapolis and life went back to my idea of normal. I had recorded a new album before Ryan got really sick and now I had to promote it. Something I had neglected to do while Ryan was dying. Sleeping with the Past had been recorded at a studio in rural Denmark called Puck. I think the idea was partly to try and avoid the press, who were crawling all over the place because of my divorce from Renata, and partly to try and avoid the kind of behaviour that had gone on during the making of Leather Jackets. In a sense, it worked. Even I couldn't figure out how to source any drugs in the depths of the Danish countryside. It was the middle of winter, freezing cold, completely desolate. You would have had more luck finding a cocaine dealer on the moon. But every night we would head out to the nearest town, Randers, and hit the pubs, marvelling at the way the Danes drank. Lovely people, very friendly, always happy to appeal to my competitive nature by challenging us to a game of darts. But you see them around booze and the old Viking heritage becomes very apparent. I shouldn't have tried to keep up with them, but my competitive nature got the better of me there too. The schnapps the locals drank was lethal. They called it North Sea Oil. I became quite used to waking up on the floor of someone else's room, with my tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth, gripped by the conviction that this particular case of alcohol poisoning was going to prove fatal. Other members of the crew fared even worse than me. On producer Chris Thomas's birthday, I hired a brass band to knock on his door first thing in the morning and launch into Happy Birthday to You. You can imagine how marvellous that sounded to a man with a raging hangover. The schnapps, the pubs, the hangovers. It's worth pointing out that I'm describing the working week here. At weekends, I let my hair down a bit. I would fly to Paris and party. There was a gay club I loved on the Rue de Caumartin called Boy. In truth, I thought I was getting a bit too old for clubbing, but the music at Boy kept me coming back. Laurent Garnier and David Guetta DJed there. It was the start of house and techno taking over in Paris's clubs, and it felt as fresh and exciting and bold as disco had back in the 70s. Whenever I hear Good Life by Inner City, I think about the dance floor in Boy going crazy. Despite my visits to Paris and the amount of North Sea oil consumed during its making, Sleeping with the Past turned out really well. The idea was to make an album influenced by old soul music, the kind of thing I'd played in nightclubs in the 60s, hence the title. You can really hear it in the songs like Amazes Me and I Never Knew Her Name. In fact, the only track I wasn't sure about was a ballad called Sacrifice. Demonstrating again the infallible commercial instincts that led me to announce I was going to strangle Gus Dudgeon if Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me was ever released, I said I didn't want it on the album. I was talked round, but then the record company wanted to release it as a single, which just seemed stupid. It was a 5-minute long ballad. No one was going to play it. First, they put it out on the B-side of a song called Healing Hands, which I thought was much more commercial. The single didn't do much until nearly a year later, in June 1990, when the DJ Steve Wright started ignoring what it said on the label and playing the other side on his Radio 1 show. Then it suddenly took off. Within 3 weeks, I had my first British solo number one. Remembering how I felt about my response to the AIDS crisis after Ryan's funeral, I decided to donate all the royalties to 4 British AIDS charities and announced I'd do the same thing with every single I released in future. I gave money to Stonewall, a new charity that was lobbying for LGBT rights in the wake of Section 28, a recent law that banned local governments and schools in Britain from promoting homosexuality. When I appeared at the International Rock Awards, a televised ceremony, I called out the host, a homophobic comedian called Sam Kinison, who specialised in jokes about AIDS. A week after Ryan's funeral, he'd been on Howard Stern's radio show sniggering about it. I said I was only there under protest, that Kinison was a pig, and that the award ceremony should never have employed him. His response was incredible. He started whining that I owed him an apology and that what I'd said was way out of line. A man who went around laughing at faggots dying, whose whole shtick was supposed to be about causing offence and saying the unsayable, was now apparently terribly offended himself about being called a name. He could dish it out, but he couldn't take it. He could whistle for his fucking apology. And I played some benefit shows for Ryan's charity at the opening of Donald Trump's new casino in Atlantic City. Gene White was my guest, but they weren't great gigs. I was propping myself up with booze and drugs, making mistakes on stage. It was nothing too drastic, the occasional forgotten lyric and the odd fluffed piano line. I doubt anyone in the audience even noticed, and no one in the band mentioned it. I've never been big on post-gig inquests where you all sit round and talk about where things went wrong. Tell people when they've played great. Don't sit there nitpicking over little errors for hours, just let it go. But deep down, I knew I'd broken one of my unwritten rules. I'd certainly raced off stage at the end of gigs before, pathetically eager to have a line. But I had made a point of never doing drugs before going on. That felt like letting an audience down. Back in Atlanta, Hugh had some news for me. He was sick of drinking and taking drugs. He knew he couldn't stop without help, so he was going into rehab. He had booked into a residential treatment program at Sierra Tucson, the same rehab center that had treated Ringo Starr for alcoholism a couple of years before. He was leaving that day. You might think, after what had happened in Indianapolis, the shame I'd felt in the company of Ryan's mum and sister, the horror of seeing myself at the funeral, that this would have been news I welcomed. I should have asked to go with him. Instead, I went ballistic. I was furious. Hugh was my latest partner in crime. If he was admitting he had a problem, that meant I had a problem. By implication, he was accusing me of being a drug addict. He wasn't the first person to suggest I needed help. After he'd stopped working for me, my valet, Mike Hewitson, had written me a very sane, level-headed letter. You've really got to stop this nonsense. Stop putting that bloody stuff up your nose. And I'd responded by refusing to speak to him for a year and a half. Tony King had tried to talk to me. He had visited me with Freddie Mercury, and afterwards Freddie had told him I looked like I was in trouble and that Tony should get involved. You need to look after your friend. Coming from Freddie, no saint when it came to booze and drugs himself, that judgment should have carried a lot of weight. Instead, I dismissed what Tony had to say as sanctimonious preaching from an alcoholic in recovery. And a couple of years before, George Harrison had tried to talk to me at an insane party I'd held at a house I was renting in LA. I'd had the garden strung with lights, got Bob Halley to fire up the barbecue and invited everyone I knew that was in town. By the middle of the evening, I was flying, absolutely out of my mind, when a scruffy-looking guy I didn't recognise wandered into the party. Who the hell was he? It must be one of the staff, a gardener. I loudly demanded to know what the gardener was doing helping himself to a drink. There was a moment's shocked silence, broken by the sound of Bob Halley's voice. Elton, that's not the fucking gardener, it's Bob Dylan. Coked out of my brain and keen to make amends, I rushed over and grabbed him and started steering him towards the house. Bob,
we can't have you in those terrible clothes. Darling, come upstairs and I'll fit you out with some of mine at once. Come on, dear.
Bob stared at me horrified. His expression suggested he was trying hard to think of something he wanted to do less than get dressed up like Elton John and drawing a blank. This was the late 80s, and one of my recent looks had involved teaming a pink suit and a straw boater with a scale model of the Eiffel Tower on top of it, so you couldn't really blame him. But full of cocky confidence, I wasn't deterred. As I continued propelling him out of the garden, I heard the unmistakable sound of George's mordant, Scouse-accented voice calling out to me. "Elton," he said, "I really think you need to go steady on the old marching powder." Bob somehow managed to talk his way out of being dressed in my clothes, but it didn't change the fact that one of the Beatles was publicly telling me to do something about my cocaine habit. I just laughed it off. This time, however, I didn't laugh it off. The full force of the Dwight family temper was unleashed. Maybe it hit home harder than before, because after Indianapolis, I knew for a fact that Hugh was right. The ensuing row was terrible. I screamed and shouted. I said the most hurtful, wounding things I could think of to Hugh. The kind of stuff so horrible it literally comes back to haunt you. You suddenly remember having said it years later, completely out of the blue, and still clench your teeth and wince. None of it made any difference. Hugh's mind was made up. He left for Arizona that afternoon. Incredibly, given the way we had parted, Hugh later asked me to visit him at the treatment centre. Big mistake. I arrived and was gone within 20 minutes, which was long enough for me to cause a huge scene. I exploded again. This place was a total shithole. The therapists were a bunch of creeps. He was being brainwashed. He had to leave at once. When he wouldn't, I stormed out and got on a plane back to London. On arrival, I went straight to my rented house and locked myself in. I holed up in the bedroom for 2 weeks, alone, snorting cocaine and drinking whiskey. On the rare occasions when I ate, I made myself sick immediately afterwards. I was up for days on end, watching porn, taking drugs. I wouldn't answer the phone. I wouldn't answer the door. If anyone knocked, I'd sit for hours afterwards in complete silence, rigid with paranoia and fear, terrified to move in case they were still outside, spying on me. Sometimes I listened to music. I played Don't Give Up by Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush over and over and over again, crying at the lyrics. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. Sometimes I spent whole days writing out pointless lists of records I owned, songs I'd written, people I would like to work with, football teams I'd seen. Anything to fill the time, to give me a reason to take more drugs, to stop myself going to sleep. I was supposed to have a Watford board meeting, but I rang them and told them I was unwell. I didn't wash. I didn't get dressed. I sat around wanking in a dressing gown covered in my own puke. It was sordid. Awful. Sometimes I never wanted to see Hugh again. Sometimes I was desperate to speak to him, but I couldn't get hold of him. He had moved into a halfway house, and after the scene I'd created at the rehab centre, no one would tell me where he was. Eventually, I made myself so ill that I realised this was it. I couldn't take it anymore. If I carried on for a couple more days, I genuinely would be dead. I'd either overdose or have a heart attack. Was that really what I wanted? I knew it wasn't. Despite my self-destructive behaviour, I didn't actually want to self-destruct. I had no idea how to live, but I didn't want to die. I'd managed to track down Hugh's ex-boyfriend, Baron Seeger, who told me that he was in a halfway house in Prescott, a city 4 hours north of Tucson. I called Hugh. He sounded nervous. He said we could meet, but that there were conditions. I had to speak to his counsellor first. He wanted to see me because there were things he wanted to say to me, but he wouldn't say them unless I had a counsellor present too. He didn't spell it out, but I suspected some kind of intervention was on the cards. I hesitated for a moment, but I was past convincing myself that although things were bad, I was intelligent enough, successful enough, and wealthy enough to sort them out on my own. I was too miserable and too ashamed of myself to even try. So I agreed. Whatever it took. Robert Key came with me, and Connie Pappas met us at the airport in LA. I phoned Hugh's counsellor. He told me that the meeting had to form part of Hugh's therapy. We would both make a list of things we didn't like about each other and read it out. I was terrified, but I did it. The next day, I was in a tiny hotel room in Prescott, facing Hugh. We sat so close that our knees were touching, holding our lists. I went first. I said that I didn't like the fact that Hugh was untidy. He left his clothes everywhere. He didn't put CDs back in their cases after he had played them. He forgot to turn the lights off after he left a room at night. Stupid, niggly, little irritations, the kind of things that get on your nerves about your partner every day. Then it was Hugh's turn. I noticed that he was shaking. He was more terrified than me. "You're a drug addict," he said. "You're an alcoholic. You're a food addict and a bulimic. You're a sex addict. You're codependent." That was it. There was a long pause. Hugh was still shaking. He couldn't look at me. He thought I was going to explode again and storm out. "Yes," I said. "Yes, I am." Both Hugh and his counsellor looked at me. "Well, do you want to get help?" his counsellor asked. "Do you want to get better?" I started to cry. "Yes," I said. "I need help. I want to get better.